Good day and welcome to Letters on Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Algerian journalist, writer, and Nobel laureate Albert Camus once wrote of the Spanish War, the Civil War between 1936 and 1939, that, quote, "Men of my generation have had Spain in our hearts. It was there that they learned that they, one, can be right and yet be beaten, that force can vanquish spirits, and there are times when courage is not rewarded." The Spanish Civil War took the hearts and minds of many people of that generation, and throngs of people, including some 2,800 Americans, traveled to Spain to join the Republic's fight against the military coup led by General Francisco Franco, who was backed at the time by Adolf Hitler and Benito Mussolini. Writers, artists, and dreamers, and anarchists and communists as well, joined the Republican attempt to quell the fascist uprising, but as often happens throughout history, they also fought among themselves. Franco would brutally complete his coup in 1939 and rule Spain until his death in 1975. Today we're going to be in conversation about this history with Adam Hochschild. He is the author of the book Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. Adam Hochschild is also a longtime journalist and author. In the 70s, he co-founded Mother Jones Magazine. He's the author of a number of books. His previous book, To End All Wars, won the Dayton Literary Prize. Adam Hochschild, it is my very good pleasure to welcome you to this radio program.
Good to be with you, Mitch.
You write this in your book. Remarkably, the conflict in Spain was at the same time both a right-wing military coup and a left-wing social revolution. This is a fascinating moment in history.
It is. And to me, it's one of the things that made this period just so fascinating to explore. I've been fascinated with it all my life. It was a right-wing coup, of course, and I think that's what most gets recorded in the history books, because, here's what happened. In 1936, Spain, which had been an electoral democracy for about 5 years, suddenly found itself faced with an uprising of extremely right-wing generals who wanted to take over the government. And from among them, a tough-talking young general, Francisco Franco, quickly emerged as the leader. And they were determined to take over the government, get rid of all trappings of democracy, turn the place into a military dictatorship, restore the power of the Catholic Church, of the big landowners, and somehow this...
Basically get it back to what, pre-1931?
Well, ideally,
a few centuries before that,
because they were... Franco used to talk quite a bit about the glories of the old Spanish Empire, and of course it was a little foggy on how that could be restored because most of Latin America had split off from Spain a long time back. Although for some Spanish army officers, the defeat by the United States in the War of 1898 still rankled, but still it would have been hard to regain those colonies. Anyway, they had dreams of glory, of establishing this glorious old Spain, and of course, when they finally did win the Civil War after nearly 3 years of very brutal fighting, Franco did establish a military dictatorship over Spain until his death in 1975. But so that was the right-wing military coup part of it. The other thing that happened simultaneously was this. When Franco and the other generals revolted in July 1936, most of the army went with them. But this coup attempt was put down in a large swath of the country, particularly Spain's northeast, city of Barcelona, surrounding Catalonia, the neighboring region of Aragon, not by loyal soldiers, but by workers' militias that had been hastily organized, badly armed, put together by left-wing political parties and trade unions. And these workers' militias found themselves in control of a huge swath of Spain. And they put into effect the most far-reaching social revolution ever seen in Western Europe. Workers took over factories, including the Ford and General Motors plants in Barcelona. Waiters took over restaurants. The dining room of the Hotel Ritz in Barcelona was turned into People's Cafeteria Number 1 for the poor. Railway workers took over the transportation system. Peasants took over these big estates. They'd worked as landless laborers. It was a fascinating moment. Europe had never seen anything like it. And the chance to look at that extraordinary moment was also part of what drew me to this book. And in the book, I try to see it through the eyes of a young American couple who found themselves in the middle of this.
Yeah, and we're going to talk about them. But what you just laid out really starts to get us into the complexities around the Spanish Civil War. For the folks that were fighting against Franco, there was a question, am I fighting to restore the Republic or am I fighting for a social revolution?
Exactly. There was a considerable split about this because the Republic was... The government of the Spanish Republic was a coalition of liberal and left-wing parties who wanted an electoral democracy that would make some reforms, especially land reform, which was a big, big issue. But these revolutionary types who were concentrated in the Northeast were basically anarchists, almost all of them anarchists, and one or two small parties aligned with them. The anarchist tradition was very strong in Spain, even though the Anarchist Trade Union Federation claimed 2 million members, even though paradoxically, by that point, the late 1930s, it had largely died out everywhere else in the world. So these folks saw themselves as fighting for a revolution as well as against Franco, who was being backed by Hitler and Mussolini. But not everybody in the Republic felt that way. There were real strains between the two groups, and there finally was a little mini civil war within the civil war in May of 1937, about 10 months after the Spanish Civil War started, where essentially a peculiar alliance between the Communist Party and the mainstream parties of the Spanish Republic put down the vestiges of this anarchist-led social revolution. Several hundred lives were lost.
Well, what event was that?
Well, it's known to historians as the May Days because it happened during the first few days of May in 1937.
By coincidence?
Actually, both sides had agreed that they would not have any demonstrations on the traditional left-wing holiday of May 1st because it could too easily erupt into violence. As it turns out, the violence erupted anyway, and it's most memorably recorded in George Orwell's memoir, Homage to Catalonia, because Orwell, who was a volunteer in Spain, fighting not with the well-known international brigades, but with the militia of a small political party, the PUM, that was allied with the anarchists, was on leave in Barcelona, home from the front, and got caught up in this street fighting, and writes about it very vividly and memorably in Homage to Catalonia.
And that was an indelible mark in this history?
Well, it certainly was for Orwell, because for him he saw the difference between how this remnants of the social revolution, which he very much admired and sympathized with, how it was suppressed and how it was portrayed in the press, especially the communist press, where, you know, they talked about suppressing people who were secret allies of Franco and being helped by Franco's agents and so on, which was complete nonsense. This had an enormous influence on him, as did the fact that there was factional fighting in the first place, and that the communist-led security police were imprisoning Spaniards and foreigners who were sympathetic to the anarchists. A British friend of his lost his life in prison. Orwell felt at the time, and said so in Homage to Catalonia, that if only this revolution had been allowed to go forward, the people of Spain could have rallied and defeated the nationalists, Franco and his people. Interestingly, 5 years later, he had changed his mind. And in an essay he wrote 5 years after this in 1943, he said what almost all historians would agree with today, which was that Franco and the Spanish nationalists, one, because they were backed by Hitler and Mussolini with an enormous stream of arms, troops, advisors, artillery, aircraft, and the Western democracies stood aside and would not sell arms to the Spanish Republic. And Orwell decided, I think correctly, that was the reason why the Republic had lost the war.
And you're also going up, could we say a professional army, if this is being led by the generals against, and maybe I don't want to over-romanticize this, but against basically a bunch of artists and writers and journalists?
Well, and workers. A majority of the Spanish army officers, professional army officers, sided with Franco and the nationalists. And their principal troops were not in Spain itself. There were Moroccan mercenaries, or Moors as they were called at the time, in Spanish Morocco, a colony across the Mediterranean, and something called the Spanish Foreign Legion, which, despite its name, was composed largely of Spaniards, many of whom were ex-convicts who were given a remission of their prison terms and if they agreed to join the army. So this was the core of the nationalist armed forces. On the other side, fighting for the Republic, were some loyal soldiers, a smaller number of loyal officers, and this ragtag bunch of militias, and then a steady stream of foreign volunteers.
Again, we are in conversation with Adam Hochschild. He is a longtime journalist and author. We are in conversation about his latest book. It is called Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. I do want to get into some of the people, the Americans that you write about who went to Spain to fight with the, which now is called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade. But before we do that, let's just add a little more context about who was supporting who in this Civil War. You mentioned that Hitler and Mussolini were supporting Franco. There were great calls for the United States, Britain, and France to support the Republican. Can we just say broadly Republican forces, or is that limiting?
Yeah. Uh-huh. No, I think you can say that. And we have to sort of pull back the camera, too, a little bit and just look at all of Europe at this time. It was a moment when fascism seemed definitely on the move, advancing aggressively. The previous year, 1935, Mussolini had sent his troops to conquer Ethiopia, which he did in a very bloody war. So that was sort of an expansion of a fascist regime outside the continent. Hitler was already making noises about expanding to the east, taking over new territories in Eastern Europe. He was clearly rearming, violation of the Versailles Treaty, building lots of new arms for Germany. So there was a sense around the world that fascism was definitely on the move. And of course, in the Far East, Japan was, expanding its power in Manchuria and elsewhere in China. Franco and the other generals staged their coup in Spain, it was a real shock, because here for the first time you had a democratic government being overthrown. And then within a 10-day period, Hitler and Mussolini came to his aid in a big way, sending aircraft, advisors, artillery, everything else.
And looking at, you mentioned Ethiopia. Something I found interesting that I did not realize is when Italy invaded Ethiopia, as we had many Americans going to Spain to fight, many black Americans wanted to go fight in Ethiopia as well at this time. But the U.S. government would not let them.
Yeah, they did want to go, because Ethiopia was, of course, one of the few remaining parts of Africa that had not been colonized. And the idea that this ancient empire was now going to become the colony of a European country was appalling to black Americans. Several hundred of them started to train to go and fight there. There were attempts to raise money for medical supplies and so on. The combination of strong opposition from the U.S. government and the enormous logistical problems of getting any kind of help to Ethiopia meant their efforts to help in the end were defeated. But it caused an enormous amount of feeling among the black community here. There were street fighting in several American cities between African Americans and Italian Americans. Mm-hmm. You know, Italian delicatessens and stores and so on got wrecked. And there were actually a number of Italian Americans who went to Europe to volunteer to join Mussolini's mm-hmm. army.
Talking about the United States not getting involved with the Spanish Civil War, and you write about one journalist, Martha Gellhorn, who would end up becoming, did he get married? Did she marry Ernest Hemingway?
She did. At this time, the time of the Spanish Civil War, she was his lover. He was still married to wife number two. She became wife number three.
And Martha Gellhorn is writing to Eleanor Roosevelt to try to encourage, have her try to work her magic to get the U.S. involved.
That's right. Martha Gellhorn's mother had been a good friend of Eleanor Roosevelt. And when Martha Gellhorn began distinguishing herself as a journalist, Eleanor said, "Why doesn't she come and live with us for a while?" The Roosevelts had the most astonishing variety of long-term house guests at the White House. So Martha Gellhorn actually lived in the White House for some weeks. This was before she went to Spain. And, you know, she felt Eleanor Roosevelt to be a close friend and mentor, wrote her an unending stream of letters from Spain, portraying the situation there, urging her to use her influence to get the United States to intervene to the extent of being willing to sell the Spanish Republic arms. It's important, I think, to realize that what people were asking for was not an American military intervention, not a gift of aid, but the Spanish Republic, paradoxically, had the money to buy arms in the West, because Spain had quite sensibly stayed neutral in World War I, while all the other major nations of Europe were, you know, losing millions of their young men and spending themselves into bankruptcy. Spain had prospered, trading with both sides, trading with the rest of the world in a way that the belligerent powers could not. So Spain had the world's fourth largest gold reserves. They were desperate to buy British, French, and American arms, but none of those countries would sell them arms, and the smaller democracies followed the lead of the big ones.
Do you think the lack of inaction had anything to do with Spain's neutrality in World War I?
No. I don't think it had anything to do with that. I think it had to do with the fact that there was a very strong desire, for different reasons in different ways, in all three of the major democracies, not to get drawn into a conflict which looked like it might expand into another world war.
Yeah.
There was a sense that there might be another world war coming, you know, Hitler rearming and all of that. They didn't want to have it happen any sooner than necessary. And there were other things at play as well. Britain was under a very conservative government at that point, the Conservative Party, and there were many people high in the British government who sympathized with Franco and felt that British investments in Spain, which were considerable, especially in the mining industry, would be safer under Franco's government than they would be under the Spanish Republic, which had very rambunctious free trade unions. In the United States, there was a very deep feeling of isolationism. The America First movement was riding high. President Roosevelt certainly was a man who hated fascism, but he also was a shrewd politician. He knew there was no constituency here for getting drawn into the Spanish Civil War. He was an avid reader of opinion polls, and the Gallup poll for this time showed that even though there were more Americans who sympathized with the Spanish Republic than who sympathized with Franco, the majority didn't sympathize with either side. In fact, a far greater number of Americans had strong feelings about whether or not King Edward VIII of Britain should renounce his throne to marry the woman he loved than they did about which side they backed in the Spanish Civil War.
Man, that's interesting, because this Civil War was being covered every day, almost every day, or frequently anyways, in the New York Times. This isn't one of those wars that went unnoticed.
Oh, and everywhere else it was covered, too. Thousands upon thousands of American newspaper articles, radio broadcasts, and so on. In the New York Times, during the time that the Spanish Civil War raged from mid-1936 to early 1939, there were more than 1,000 front-page stories about the war, which is more than on any other single subject. You know, the rise of Hitler, the re-election of Roosevelt, the toll of the Great Depression, anything else.
And the New York Times is also a fascinating story, or a fascinating aspect to this story. It had two main journalists covering the Civil War, Herbert L. Matthews and William P. Kearney. Herbert L. Matthews was, I guess, embedded with the Republican forces. William P. Kearney was embedded with the Nationalist forces. And they both actually ended up really feeling strongly towards each of those two sides.
Yeah.
You call it a Civil War, a Civil War at the New York Times.
Yeah. It was an amazing story because, like many reporters in many situations, both of these journalists became avid partisans of the people they were covering. Completely blind to the faults of their various sides. Matthews, covering things from the side of the Spanish Republic, was, I think, the better reporter, and he had a well-deserved reputation for always wanting to see things from the front lines. And it was actually a lot easier in the Spanish Republic to get to the front lines. The government did not place many restrictions on where journalists could go. They censored people's stories, but the censorship was light, and Matthews realized that if he called his paper's Paris bureau at the time, when the Spanish censor, who normally listened in, went out for dinner, he could say whatever he wanted. But he became an avid partisan of the Spanish Republic, and for the rest of his life used to talk about what a great crusade it was, and how any time he met somebody who had fought for Republican Spain, he felt he met a brother. Obviously, you can't say this in the long gray columns of the New York Times, so he moderated his language somewhat there. On the other side, William P. Kearney, the Times correspondent in Nationalist Spain, was such an enthusiast of the side that he was covering that years later, after he retired from the Times, Franco's government gave him a job as a paid propagandist in the United States. So, and these two guys absolutely hated each other. And occasionally you can find them taking digs in print at each other, which is quite fun. Because, of course, in the New York Times, you have to do things in very restrained ways. But at one point, for example, in the winter of 1937-38, Kearney, on the Nationalist side, reported that Nationalist troops had retaken the provincial capital of Teruel, a city which the Republic had just captured and won headlines around the world by doing so. Matthews, who had just been at the Teruel front, knew this was not true, and knew that Kearney, who liked to report from well behind the lines, was just reading Franco's press releases. Matthews went back to Teruel, where he'd been a number of times, wrote a dispatch dateline from the city, saying that it was still in Republican hands, and then adding something, I can't remember the exact words, but it was like saying something like, in this war, one has to see things with one's own eyes to know what's happening. And everybody knew that that was a dig at Kearney.
So how did the Times handle that then? Were they getting at all contradictory reports?
Well, I give the New York Times credit for wanting to cover this war from both sides. And the Times is a paper that is very loyal to its reporters. And they didn't rein in either Matthews or Kearney very much, and published both their dispatches pretty much as they were written. Matthews was quite thin-skinned, and he kept carbon copies of all of his dispatches as he sent them to the Times, and always got deeply upset when he got the actual newspaper and saw that his extremely long-winded reports had been cut down somewhat. And he left those carbon copies in his papers to the library at Columbia University so that future generations and people like me could come along and see how much he had been censored by the paper. But in fact, I looked at those, I compared them with his stories as printed, and did not feel there was much censorship.
Tell me about Ernest Hemingway and the Spanish Civil War. His book, For Whom the Bells Toll, is based on this war.
Ernest Hemingway was, curiously, because up to that point in time, he'd been really one of the most non-political of American writers, became an ardent backer of the Spanish Republic, signed on to write pieces from Spain for the North American Newspaper Alliance, which was a consortium of 50 newspapers here, made 4 trips to Spain during the war of several months each and wrote many dispatches. And during the war, he sort of regarded himself as a partisan and didn't want to put anything in his stories which gave any indication that the Republic might lose this war, although in his heart he knew that would happen. Did not talk about the factional conflicts on the Republican side. And, in fact, at one point actually took part in a Republican guerrilla raid across the lines where they blew up a railway at night, an experience which he drew on when he wrote his novel For Whom the Bell Tolls after the war. When he did write that novel after the war ended, and a couple of short stories as well, he then showed a much more capacious political understanding than he had allowed to be shown in his newspaper dispatches, showed some of the factional fighting on the Republican side, showed the paranoid behavior of a couple of communist officials. But he still, you know, to the day he died, wished that the Spanish Republic had won the Civil War.
There is one reporter that you speak highly of in the book, Virginia Cowles.
Mm-hmm.
Am I saying her name correctly? Cowles?
Yeah. I ended up feeling that she was the best English language reporter in Spain, very little known and remembered today. She was 26 years old when she went to Spain, never covered a war before. And in those days, it was not easy for a woman to be a journalist, especially a foreign correspondent. And in a way, she played the feminine card. Everybody who met her wrote about how elegantly dressed she was, her jewelry, her high heels. She was very good at saying, oh, I've just arrived. I don't know where anything is. Can you help me out? Can you tell me what's going on? But she noted everything. She noted all kinds of things that other people missed. Her writing is terrific, and she did something which virtually no other journalist, with rare exceptions, succeeded in doing, which was to cover the war from both sides. After reporting from the Republic for several months, something which usually guaranteed that you would not be admitted to nationalist Spain as a journalist from there, she pulled all kinds of strings, talked to people she knew, finally managed to get herself admitted to nationalist Spain, and became the first journalist of any kind to hear nationalist Spanish officers confirming that their forces had bombed Guernica, which is something that Franco and Hitler strenuously were denying at the time. They said the famous destruction of Guernica had happened because the town was destroyed by repeating Republican forces, which blew it up as they retreated. The book that Virginia Cowles later wrote, she wrote newspaper dispatches first for the Hearst newspapers here, then for the Sunday Times in London. But the book that she wrote, Looking for Trouble, still makes a good read today.
Still a good read today.
Absolutely. And it was reissued recently. And I don't know if any of the other American journalists or British journalists who wrote memoirs in Spain, if their books are even still in print, but they all feel pretty musty to me compared to Virginia Cowles.
Again, we are in conversation with Adam Hochschild. He is a longtime journalist and author, and we are talking about his latest book, which is called Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. Okay, so the United States, France, Britain all refused to really get involved. Of course, people from these countries went to go fight, mm-hmm. but the governments themselves refused to sell arms to the Republic. There is one country that will,
mm-hmm.
and that's the Soviet Union.
That's right. It was not another democracy. It was Stalin's Russia. Stalin held back for the first couple of months after the war began, hoping that Britain and France would not want an ally of Hitler on their doorstep, and that they would sell arms to Spain. Seeing that they were not doing so, he decided to do so for a mixture of motives, because no superpower, whether the Soviet Union then or the United States today, ever does anything out of the goodness of their own heart. Stalin was, of course, world-class paranoid, but he was smart enough to know that he faced a real enemy in Hitler. He didn't want there to be Hitler to have another ally in Western Europe.
And people's views of Stalin, well, I guess we already had the split with Trotsky at this point,
right.
but as we remember Stalin today, is not quite what people knew then.
Right. And he, having this archenemy, Trotsky at the time, fancying himself, Stalin, sort of in competition with Trotsky to lead the left-wing movements of the world, which was not quite true, in fact. I think, actually, the Trotskyists were much weaker and more divided than Stalin realized. He felt that positioning the Soviet Union as an ally of the Spanish Republic was something very important to do. So, starting in the fall of 1936, about 3 months after the war began, he began selling arms to Spain in return for this enormous supply of gold that Republican Spain had. And these arms were essential. Without them, and particularly fighter planes and pilots, tanks and tank drivers, without them, Franco and the Nationalists would have conquered Madrid by the end of 1936. Also, very important, Stalin not only supplied arms, but passed the word to communist parties all over the world, begin recruiting volunteers to fight in Spain. There already were several thousand volunteers in Spain from other countries who had gone there on their own to fight, had joined some of these workers' militias that we were talking about. Stalin wanted to sort of control and channel that process, and indeed, the world's communist parties were formidable organizational apparatuses, did begin recruiting people in many countries, put together a force that in the end totaled somewhere between 35 and 40,000 people. These were the famous international brigades, and proved to be a very important military force in the war.
Is that different than the Abraham Lincoln Brigade?
Well, of these international brigaders, 35 to 40,000 of them, 2,800 of them were Americans. There was no unit called the Abraham Lincoln Brigade during the war. There was an Abraham Lincoln Battalion, then there was a George Washington Battalion, then both battalions got so mauled in combat that they were merged and became the Lincoln Washington Battalion. Then there were some other Americans who fought in a unit that had the names of some Canadian patriots, but most of the unit was American, and there was an American medical detachment as well. But after the war, when everybody came home, they all began referring to themselves as Lincoln Brigaders.
Were there a part of these brigades that the Communist Party helped form?
They were.
Bob Merriman?
Bob Merriman was a guy perhaps of special interest to people here in Berkeley.
He taught at UC Berkeley.
He did. He and his wife Marion both went to the University of Nevada at Reno as undergraduates. Bob was played end on the football team at one point. They got married on graduation day, then moved to Berkeley, where Bob was a graduate student in economics, and became head teaching fellow in the economics department. One of his fellow students was a young Canadian named John Kenneth Galbraith. They lived in Berkeley.
The great economist.
Yeah.
Sort of the New Deal era economist.
That's right. New Deal and after.
Yeah.
And the Merrimans lived on the north side of campus, actually just a couple of blocks away from where we are, maybe 10 blocks away from where we are here at KPFA today. And then they went to Russia. They were both communist sympathizers, although they didn't actually join the party until they got to Spain. They went to Russia, where he was gathering material for a PhD thesis, and then from Russia he volunteered to go and fight in Spain. When he was wounded, Marion, his wife, came there to nurse him. He recovered. She stayed on in Spain and was the only American woman working at International Brigade's headquarters.
Did any women fight?
Yes. The only armed women, really, were in these workers' militias that we were talking about. In the Republic's army, itself, there were certainly plenty of women who were nurses, clerical workers, and so on, and I'm sure many of them got killed or wounded in the course of the war. But actual combatants, women combatants, one would have to look at these workers' militias.
We'd also be remiss if we didn't bring up Oliver Law, who was a veteran of the U.S. Army, and for a short time, he was in charge of the Lincoln Brigade, African-American man.
That's right. The Communist Party was very fixed on giving important roles to black Americans, which, of course, virtually no other political organizations in the U.S. did at that time. There were about 90 African-American volunteers among those 2,800 Americans, and a couple of them, like Oliver Law, were U.S. military veterans. Oliver Law was, just for a few days, commander of the Abraham Lincoln Battalion in Spain. He was killed a couple of days after receiving that post. But it was the first time that an African-American had been commanding a predominantly white unit of Americans in uniform, and it would be years and years and years before anything like that happened in the U.S. Army.
Talk to me about the dynamic then back in Spain of communist and anarchist fighting on the same side, though at the same time fighting against each other. And I think the confusion of this, and I think sometimes here at KPFA or maybe any progressive, especially Progressive Media Institute, when someone new comes in, they're trying to, wait, what's going on here? I don't understand all this, yeah. Right? This infighting and what's coming on. But you kind of tell this story by the experience of two other Americans, Lois and Charles Orr.
Well, let's talk about them and sort of see this conflict through their eyes. To me, discovering them was just one of the great joys of working on this book, because when I set out to cover a particular topic, whether it's the Spanish Civil War or something else, I don't want to concentrate too much on people that readers are going to know about already. You can't avoid Ernest Hemingway and George Orwell, and they are extraordinary figures, but otherwise I'd like to focus on people you're not likely to have heard of. Well, here's this American couple. Lois Orr, 19 years old, was a student at the University of Louisville in Kentucky, her hometown. In the spring of 1936, just before the war began, she had married an economics instructor at the university, Charles Orr, a little bit older than she, and they'd gone to Europe on their honeymoon. They were leftists, but of a very independent anti-Stalinist stripe. They were members sort of the left wing of Norman Thomas's American Socialist Party. They were in Europe on their honeymoon. They heard about this right-wing military coup attempt in Spain, and then they began hearing about this remarkable social revolution in the Northeast. And Lois, who was very much the live wire of this couple, said to her somewhat older, somewhat stodgier husband, "We have to go and see this." So they hitchhiked to the Spanish border, crossed it 2 months after the war began, mid-September 1936, spent the next 10 months living and working in Barcelona. And Lois wrote the most extraordinary series of letters home during that time. Also spent much of the rest of her life rewriting a memoir of this period that was never published.
Get the papers?
Yes. Her daughter very kindly made copies of several drafts of this memoir for me. So seeing this through their eyes was quite extraordinary. Here they are, the young Americans, they get off the train in Barcelona. One thing that they find is that young idealists from all over Europe had come there to see this social revolution. For example, one person who moved in their circles and worked in the same building as Charles, and for a time they lived in the same hotel, was a 23-year-old political refugee from Germany named Willy Brandt. Three decades later, he'd be Chancellor of West Germany. So they found it thrilling because they saw all of this happening. They saw you know, they, as foreign volunteers for the revolution, they were given free housing. They were welcomed with open arms. They found a sign, huge banner at the Barcelona railway station when they arrived saying, "Welcome, foreign comrades." And they saw this anarchist moment in full swing.
And they're anarchists. Are they anarchists?
Well, they considered themselves sort of democratic socialists. But what they knew was happening, and what everybody knew was happening, was that here was a revolution which was bubbling from the bottom up and not imposed from the top down as it happened in the Soviet Union. So they found it quite thrilling. But they gradually began to realize that there were divisions here. Charles Orr, looking for work and looking for a political home, went to a building that was the headquarters of the United Socialist Party and found somebody who spoke English and volunteered to help and said, "I'm here to help the revolution." And this Spanish woman said to him, "There is no revolution. There is only a war against fascism." And then he realized that, in fact, he'd been sent to the communists and that that was the view that they were taking, because the Communist Party was very hostile to this idea of a bottoms-up revolution. Plus, you know, I don't like to give the Communist Party credit for anything, but I think that they were right about one thing, which is that attractive as revolution may appear to us, and attractive as some of the ideas of Spanish anarchism are, and, you know, there certainly is much that's alluring there and that attracted somebody like Orwell when he wrote Homage to Catalonia, I don't think it's a good idea to try to make a social revolution at the same time as you are engaged in a desperate war for survival.
Against fascists.
Against an army backed by Hitler and Mussolini. Because all of the things which make this kind of bottoms-up revolution idea attractive, you know, defiance of authority, elimination of hierarchy, and so on, these are not the building blocks of effective armies. And there are situations where, unfortunately, at times you need an army.
It just cut right through.
Yeah.
Yeah. Explain to me then what was the dynamic between communists and anarchists?
Well, there were a lot of tensions. Oddly enough, and this has to do with sort of Stalin's peculiar paranoia, the greatest enemy for the Spanish and Soviet communists in Spain was not the anarchist movement, because the anarchists came from a different tradition. It was a relatively small political party, the PUM. That's the acronym of its Spanish initials, the one in whose militia Orwell fought, that was kind of semi-allied with the nationalists. This party's leaders were former communists. One of them had lived in the Soviet Union. They had defected from the world's communist movement. And, of course, in any messianic movement, a heretic is much more dangerous than the heathen. So The Spanish communists in their propaganda never really took on the anarchists in a big way. And it was a genuinely widespread popular movement in Spain, but they lavished an immense amount of ferocity on this quite small party, the PUM. And it was its leaders who were singled out for arrest and imprisonment. So this was, you know, this was just due to the shape of Stalin's paranoia more than anything else.
And talk to me about, in reading your book, I was very moved by, not the beauty, actually, but the savagery of the nationalist forces and the pure brutality that they did to put down this republic.
Well, this was a war that was extremely brutal on both sides, of course, as wars so often are, but perhaps especially so for the nationalists. The Spanish nationalists, Franco and his fellow generals, had been formed in part by their experience in colonial wars in Africa, particularly in Spanish Morocco, where there had been extremely bloody fighting throughout the 1920s. Franco once came back with his soldiers carrying 12 severed heads of Moroccan rebels that he'd killed, that they'd killed during an expedition. And Franco once said, "Without Africa, I can hardly explain myself." So they brought this colonial war mentality, and colonial wars tend to be the nastiest of all, where, you know, Europeans, Americans, whatever, feel they're fighting against savages and anything goes. They brought that mentality to Spain, and right from the beginning of their rebellion, they targeted civilians in huge numbers. It's estimated that the Spanish nationalists deliberately assassinated 150,000 civilians during the course of the Spanish Civil War and another 20,000 afterwards.
And when we say civilians, or are we talking about people that are actively involved?
We're talking about people whose crime was to be a member of a trade union, to be in any way a supporter of the previous democratic government, to be connected to any kind of movement that wasn't purely Spanish. They were paranoid about anybody who belonged to the Rotary Club or was involved with a Montessori school, because these were international movements. Above all, you know, members of the Communist Party, although initially there were not too many of those, members of the Socialist Party, members of this coalition of liberal and left-wing parties in the Spanish Republic, these people were all sought out and deliberately murdered. More than 40 elected parliamentary deputies were murdered by the nationalists. And people were treated savagely in other ways, thrown into crowded prisons. Dissident women had the nationalist emblem of yoke and arrows branded on their breasts. It was an extreme...
Rape was a common...
Mass rape. Organized, you know, and okayed by commanding officers was routine. And they even boasted about it to American and British correspondents covering the war from the nationalist side. At the same time, we have to say there was a lot of violence on the other side, too. Spain had been a very violent place for many years. It's estimated that in territory held by the Spanish Republic, some 49,000 people were killed by angry mobs.
The clergy were killed.
Yeah, including 7,000 members of the clergy, because the Catholic Church was seen as being allied with the nationalists, the big landowners, and so on. And actually, in For Whom the Bell Tolls, Hemingway gives a very vivid picture of this violence on the Republican side. The Republican government, to its credit, after the first two or three months of the war, tried desperately hard to get this violence under control and really did pretty much bring it to a stop. But in the first couple of months of the war, it was quite nasty.
What more can you tell me about the Catholic Church and its role in this war?
Well, the Catholic hierarchy in Spain was by far the most reactionary in Europe. They were seen by anybody on the left as, you know, promoting a better world to come, so don't worry about trying to improve conditions in this world that we're living in. And they controlled all education in Spain up until Spain came into the democratic era in 1931, and education was segregated by sex. Co-education was seen as a left-wing plot. Segregated by sex, and education was for women, was very strong on sewing and religion and not much else. And one of the reforms that the Spanish Republic started to make when it came into being was to take education out of the hands of the Catholic Church. And this was why the Republic was such anathema to Catholics everywhere. And you can see pictures of Spanish cardinals and bishops raising their right hand in that palm-out fascist salute alongside Franco's generals.
One last question about the anarchists, because hardly ever do you hear of anarchists controlling, even just for a little while.
That's right.
Were they particularly strong in Catalonia?
They might control a radio station, yeah. But not much more.
Well, Was it Catalonia? Where
They were strong in Catalonia and Aragon next door in a few other regions. And there are many reasons for this. Some Spanish village culture along the Mediterranean coast of Spain involved villages where things like fishing boats and nets were collectively owned. Sometimes there were patches of collectively owned land in villages in eastern Spain. And for that and other reasons, anarchism took quite deep root there.
And they ran the place.
During these couple of months.
That's about as long as
Well,
it's a good amount of time.
Yeah, it began to run up against all sorts of obstacles, one of which was wartime shortages of materials. Another, I think, was the fact that, you know, in any kind of modern economy, you need to exchange all kinds of complex things. Spanish anarchists, as a matter of principle, opposed the use of money, and actually in some towns and villages actually made bonfires of paper money, saying everything will be barter from here on. Well, you know, barter has been used by people for thousands of years, and it's fine if you're bartering a jug of wine for a loaf of bread or something, but when you're trying to trade in aircraft parts and X-ray machinery and so on, it gets pretty complicated. I think also they could get this anarchist-led revolution off to a good start because it started during the summer, and then there was the harvest season, and there was plenty of food. But then there were shortages because factories were cut off from their traditional sources of raw material. The abundance from the harvest was gone. So things tended to get quite a bit less revolutionary, even well before the last vestiges of it were suppressed in May of 1937.
I enjoyed the photos in the middle of your book very much, and you do have this great photo of anarchists with their flags, and I was just looking at it, and I thought I could see remnants of photos that I've seen from Occupy Oakland in 2011 or something.
That's
like that.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, there is this, you know, spirit and tradition that flourishes again and again throughout the world, which there are many admirable things about.
Adam Hochschild, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Mitch. It's been a pleasure.
Again, the name of the book, Spain in Our Hearts, Americans in the Spanish Civil War, 1936 to 1939. That does it for Letters on Politics. The show is produced by Elizabeth Pearl. Kirsten Thomas is our engineer. You can find our past shows online at kpfa.org. I'm Mitch Jezrich. Thanks for listening.